today's podcast is covering a topic that every sailor needs to be quite aware of and informed on. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I don't want to delay. Let's just roll right in. What's going on, sailors? Welcome to the On Deck Podcast. I'm Sailor Smurf, coming to you from the Yacht Rigger headquarters located in Salt Creek Marina in sunny St. Pete, Florida. Really cool episode today on a topic that, like I said, we all need to be super informed on. This recording was done about a year ago as it relates to the actual interview that I have here with Stephen, co-owner of the Yacht Rigger. And we really just dig into all things related to hurricanes. And I was super green at the time. I'm still learning everything today, as you guys know. But this was, I hadn't even heard the term spaghetti model yet. So this is just an absolute novice sitting down with someone who's been sailing his entire life, not just working as a professional in the marine industry, but Stephen has... boating is an extension of his soul and of his body. I mean, he just knows everything about it so intimately that he has to work to even unwind things to such a novice level that I'm at when I'm interviewing him here. And it's still the same when he's talking to me today. He's just got to try to simplify it so I can track with all this new information in the sailing world. Stephen, of course, is not a meteorologist. He is a trained rigger, as well as a few other things that he's got all kinds of professional background in. But while not being a meteorologist, like I say, being a lifelong boater, he's got all kinds of cool insight. It's a really neat interview. I think you guys are going to enjoy it. I don't want to ramble on. I want to get right into it. Do check in the description, though, the show notes, and you'll find links to different things that the yacht rigger likes to use around the yard that are useful tools for them, as well as you'll also find a link down there to our YouTube video channel, the On Deck channel, and there you'll find all kinds of content and episodic stuff. I don't want to keep going. Let's hear this interview taken, like I say, about a year and a half ago between Stephen and myself, all things hurricanes. I hope you guys enjoy. Talking about hurricanes, what are some things to be aware of in relation to boating and hurricanes?
So much to think about. The first thing, obviously, is figuring out whether or not the hurricane is going to hit you directly, if it's tracking for you, how fast it's moving, and just general predictive knowledge. So trying to figure out what the experts are saying and understand how much of an emergency this actually is. Because while the storm is still 5-6 days away, you may not necessarily even, it may not be worth panicking yet. It could absolutely miss you. Hurricanes make massive directional changes. And so you can stare at spaghetti models all day long, and it's very rare to have a really solid prediction. But
you say spaghetti model?
I did say spaghetti model.
What is that?
So spaghetti models are the models that meteorologists do that are basically lines drawn on a map that show you all the potential pathways of a hurricane, and they tend to look like spaghetti because they literally don't have a great idea which way it's going to go. And so the spaghetti model is the chart/map that you're looking at.
That makes sense, where you see all the potential trails
exactly
where it could go. I'd never heard that. Wow, spaghetti model.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So you start looking at that going, okay.
Okay, so you start there.
Is it, and you can start doing your early prep at that point, and your primary goal with your boat when prepping for a hurricane needs to be to reduce windage and securely tie the boat up. So those two things. You want to strip it down so that there's absolutely minimal in the way of cloth, of course. So all your soft fabric stuff, biminis, dodgers, cockpit enclosures, for sure that stuff is obvious. It's just got to come off. Sails need to come off, sail covers. I've gone to the extreme when we prepped for Irma, where I literally skied all the halyards on the masts, so wow, that there were no halyard tails hanging down, and bundled them all at the mast base and then lashed them to the mast. So it was just one kind of lump at the mast base. No additional rigging up there. Because we were expecting, with Irma, I think they were tracking wind speeds well north of 100 miles an hour, if I remember correctly. So we were expecting a catastrophic, it gets to Category 5, and then there is no Category 6. But and the reason for that is basically nothing really survives a Cat 5. And so why even draw a line beyond that? So we were expecting death and destruction with Irma. And thankfully, we missed it by the 40, 50 miles or something like that, that changed Irma for us. But in that case, stripped all the halyards all the way up to, pulled them all the way up to the masthead.
So you're just trying to get it where you only have the halyards coming out of the mast.
There's
exits.
Literally a figure
so
eight
nothing,
knot tied
everything's
at the top.
Internal.
Exactly. There's little stubs of halyards sticking out the top of the mast, and that's it. So all that stuff just adds up and accumulates. If you think about windage, you know, holding on to, try to hold a halyard straight that is secured to the masthead and go hold it when it's blowing 30 or 40. I mean, there's 20, 30 pounds of load, it feels like, on that halyard. Now imagine six of them when it's blowing 80 or 90, and that's an incredible amount of load on the mast, which could load up your rigging, but also just load up your dock lines. So everything accumulatively eventually falls onto your dock lines and or anchor, depending on what you're secured, you know, what your securing method is.
Sure. And so, are you leaving like a topping lift to go up on? Like, how do you get a skied halyard if you don't go up?
I left one messenger.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I had one just eighth inch.
Oh, that makes sense.
Dacron messenger.
One of the halyards has a messenger you can pull down.
Exactly.
And go, so then go up on that on a chair.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. But yeah, I mean, it's a good question for sure. And I guess
I know it seems obvious to you, but I'm like, wait,
right?
If I sky all my
halyards, sky them all. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
At least
no, I had
make one retrievable
piece of leech line that was retrievable. Okay. I guess, and you could, I suppose, leave a topping lift if it was just one. Either way, you're reducing that wind load significantly, sure, by getting rid of all the other halyards. So,
I think that messenger though, just that thin line,
yeah,
going up makes
very little resistance.
Perfect sense. Sure.
Yeah. And worst case, if you had to, you know, figure out a way to climb your mast with a prusik system or something like that after the fact, you know, it would be okay if, as long as you survive the hurricane.
And what's a prusik system?
It's a climbing method that is a constrictive line that you can do it around the mast. I've done it before.
Is it like tree logger?
Kind of like a tree logger style.
Use spike.
Yeah, but okay. You slide the a knot system up the rig and then sit down. You have two of them and you slide one up.
Oh, it's kind of a slinky
then,
looking.
Yes.
Like worming your way
up.
It's
very, you know, it's not fun at all,
right,
doing it that way, but I've done it, and yeah,
it's like worst case scenario,
half an hour to get up the rig.
Oh goodness.
But yeah, so it's a workout. But
yeah, so probably keep a messenger.
Yeah, leave one halyard down, leave a messenger, but
yeah,
but minimize your windage. So by the time you're fairly certain, and that was, I was doing that stuff on like the last day before, you know, it's perfectly calm, it's a beautiful day always before a hurricane hits, because the hurricane has sucked all the bad weather into it, and everything around the hurricane is just this beautiful pristine weather. But so all the extreme prep, when we knew Irma was going to hit, that's when I started skying halyards. It was the day before, while after I'd done all my dock lines, which I had done in the preceding days. So yeah, we're at the point now where we know a hurricane's coming, we know it's going to be bad, we've taken all our canvas down, and you start thinking about the rotational direction of the storm and which side of the hurricane's going to hit you, and start thinking about which way you want your boat facing for the predominant winds. Now, if it's going to be a direct hit, you're going to get winds from all directions. So we know the storm is coming, and you want to start thinking about which side of the storm is going to hit you. And if it's a direct hit, it doesn't matter as much, because the front of the storm is going to go over you. You're going to have the eye and then the back of the storm, and they're going to be rotating in opposite directions. But it really does matter which direction the hurricane's hitting you from, and which portion, especially in a big hurricane like Irma that was 140 miles across or something like that at its peak. A lot of hurricanes are smaller, but you can predict what the predominant wind direction is going to be, and for most boats, you want the bow of the boat facing into the wind. Now, that's not always an option
because you might be
at a marina
slip. Or something.
Exactly.
Right?
But you can 180 your boat in a marina, yeah, to at least try. But if you're going to be side on, you're going to be side on.
It is what it is, yeah.
But
if you're at an anchorage, like where you're just trying to, you know,
ride it
seek
out,
shelter somewhere and ride it out, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
You
want to be aware. And there's situations where people will ride out the storm on one side of an anchorage, and while the eye is passing over, move, because sometimes you have 20 minutes, 30 minutes.
Interesting.
Of, you know, peace and quiet in the eye of the storm, and move to another location. That's an extreme example. Having the eye go directly over you is super rare anyway. But
how wide is the eye on average? Do you any idea?
I feel like the eye of Irma was about a mile wide.
Oh, wow. So that's going to be pretty rare.
Yeah.
Where you happen to be.
Yeah, where you have enough time.
So okay. when you're looking at the weather pattern and you have that rotating disc that's making its way down to you, you're getting the bow of the boat into that predominant wind direction, if you have the option, best you can.
Correct.
I mean, that's the idea.
Exactly.
And if it's coming, and if it's going to be on your beam, I mean, it is what it is. Is there
kind of is what it is. And I actually just looked it up. The Eye of Irma was between 20 and 40 kilometers wide. Irma was massive, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Irma was one of the, between 20 and 40 miles. I'm sorry. 32 to 64 kilometers wide.
Interesting.
So it was a mega storm, though, like super storm, once in a 100-year kind of thing. So, people talk about, I think a friend of ours who was living in St. Martin at the time, and Irma passed directly over them, they had like 30 minutes of just perfect peace and quiet while the eye went over them, and then knew like absolute fury and turmoil was coming again, and there's nothing they could do about it. So they lost the whole top of their house. Like, they were down in the basement, and this is, a land-based story, but sat there, came outside and walked around for a while, and then we're like, all right, we'll get back down below. Here comes the big gray wall, and it's like something out of a movie. Just wild.
Man, that is.
Yeah, but thankfully that didn't happen to us in a boat situation. But when Irma came, it was looking like it was going to kind of skirt up the coast, up the Gulf Coast, and we were in St. Pete at the time. And so we figured we were going to get the way it was going to hit us, we figured we would have a lot of northerly winds. So what I actually ended up doing was facing the boat to the north. We were in a canal tied up to a dock, but I put two anchors out off the bows of the boats across the canal up to the north to stop us getting blown onto the seawall. And then basically started adding dock lines. And so one of the most important things when prepping for a hurricane is to make sure you have A, high quality dock lines, something that is stretchy but strong and has chafe protection on it. Chafe is by far your number one enemy. And then long enough dock lines. Ideally, you are going to have enough dock line that can withstand a surge. So if you have really short dock lines, like you're tied to a very close piling to a cleat and your line's only 4 feet long and you have a bunch of tide rise, you're going to snap pull the cleat off or snap the line. It's a big deal.
The inexperienced
making
person.
Sure you have long angles on your lines is a huge one.
Yeah.
And trying, if you're lucky enough to be in a marina where you can pull your boat off the dock using tie poles or the opposite finger, floating your boat in the middle of its slip to where you're having to do like a long jump, or people use paddle boards to get from their boat back to the dock before the storm hits, so that all of your dock lines are even. So you have a spider web of lines around your boat that are all evenly loaded. Now they're going to start loading up first, because if you have your primary dock lines and they all load up first and start taking 100% load and your secondaries are there in case the primaries fail, it kind of negates the point. You should rather have all of your dock lines evenly loaded, primary and secondary, so they can share the load, as opposed to, waiting till one set fails, and if one set fails, the second one's highly likely to fail anyway. Why would the other one survive when the first one didn't? So double and or triple dock lines, whatever your cleats can handle in terms of space, and evenly loaded, well spaced out dock lines is a huge one.
And you mentioned opposite finger. What's opposite
so a finger in the marina? So like the part of the dock that's poking out that you can also tie dock lines to. Because sometimes you're just side tied.
Yeah.
Like the last hurricane or storm I went through, it was only last year, but it was kind of a last minute storm that we had 2 days notice or something for. And I'm in my current slip, don't really have the ability to tie to anything other than where I'm side tied there, but I actually ended up taking two anchors out about 100 feet from my boat and dropping them just in the middle of the marina, and they had chain on them, so no boats, it didn't matter. And then we loaded them up to hold us off the dock, because that storm came straight out the southeast, and it just hammered us into the dock the entire storm. But my one stern anchor was loaded up immensely for about 8 hours, and thankfully, it worked. It held us off. So I'm a firm believer, if you're in any kind of marina situation where you have the ability to get some anchors out there, obviously don't, advertise that you're driving around throwing anchors out, because some marinas don't like it. In fact, our marinas awesome. They were, you know, they asked us what we were doing, and we told them, and they said, all right, guys, just, you know, make sure you can get them up afterwards. And we said, sure.
Okay. And a huge storm like that, everyone's probably pretty understanding.
Yes, you know, everyone works together.
Don't endanger anybody else, but...
Exactly. And don't use, like, floating line on your anchor rope, which would be foolish anyway. But
right.
And they required that we put buoys on them, actually, so that people knew where they were, which was interesting, which I kind of found was almost more of a navigation hazard, because someone motoring out could then get the buoy line caught in their prop.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of torn on that one, but they wanted us to, so we did.
And
we even went so far as to go across 150 feet in some cases to fingers that were way far away, and we slung chain around the pilings and let the chain sink down to the bottom with a piece of line attached to
good
it.
Idea.
So it was attached really down near the base where there's, you know, not nearly as much leverage happening on the piling, and using those to hold boats off the dock. I couldn't do that in my slip, but it's a super secure way of doing it.
Excellent.
So, and then a lot of people ask the question, or this is a hot debate, do I stay on the boat during the hurricane? Do I leave it? The generally safe answer is just get off the boat and go stay at your friend's condo or go to a hotel. Be safe. Your boat should be insured. I lean towards, if it's a cat two, well, one or two, I'm staying on board. I'm not overly concerned. That's not kill you typical.
Right. And there's some adjustments you might need to do during a storm, right? I mean, if it's safe enough to be on the boat, that's not a bad place to be.
Exactly. You're not going to get much sleep at all. You're going to be up adjusting and making tweaks to dock lines. I actually had, in the last storm, I had two, what I called my, like, cheater lines. They were free lines of they were 5/8 Dacron, so stretchy lines, not really dock line material, but I had it tied off to a forward spring and aft spring, basically. And so I was able to use my electric primary winch if my boat started, when the tide came up, if I had to make adjustments, because there's no way you can push your boat around, or it's incredibly hard to physically push your boat around. But I could use my electric winch to move the boat fore or aft a foot or two, and then adjust all my dock lines and then take the load off the winch. Now, I would never try to do that if it was blowing 75, 80. Thankfully, that storm was only blowing in the 60s, 50, peaking in the 60s. So nothing crazy, but it was super helpful to be able to make those adjustments easily. But absolutely, in general, you want to be there, in, if it's safe, to make adjustments and add chafe protection if you notice something's chafing through. I actually do this thing where your cleats always seem to be too full when there's a storm coming, because you're trying to add so many dock lines. And I take half-inch Dyneema and make a two-foot-long loop and luggage hitch it, or cow hitch it, through my cleat. So I have this long loop that I can tie extra dock lines to that's not going to take up extra space. Not super easy to adjust, but I can adjust those from the dock.
Yeah, and it gives you some extra room. Just some more surface area to work with.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. What about when you, any tips for when you are out and you're sailing, traveling the world, there's not a marina to go into, and you're trying to find safe anchorage somewhere? What do you look for?
That's a good question. It's not something I've personally had to do, but I've spoken to several people that have done it. The most popular one is to find some mangroves. If you're in any part of the world where there's mangroves or a protected mangrove bay, ideally you find the smallest possible enclosed area of bay that's going to have the least fetch, so the sea state's going to be not of concern. You're just fighting the wind. And if you can find any kind of land shelter in terms of, like, a tall bank of trees, not most of the places we cruise in are pretty flat, but if you're in a part of the world where there is some kind of landmass to shelter you from the wind, of course, the more land shelter you can get, the better.
And you're trying to obviously put that land between you and the wind.
Correct.
The direction that the wind is
exactly.
going.
Exactly, yeah. If you're on the exposed side, on the windward side, and there's 20 miles of open ocean, yeah, not going to work so well. But, yeah, finding the most sheltered possible
area. And mangroves. What?
Mangroves are great because you can tie to them. So people will pull their boat literally right up close to mangroves and physically tie around 2-inch thick mangrove branches and string that spiderweb I was talking about, multiple dock lines, off to as many mangroves as possible. They're incredibly strong. People go through entire storms and don't break them. Because, I mean, these are, you know, plants that have learned to survive in that crazy, crazy environment.
Yeah, that makes sense. Real complex root systems.
And they give. So there's no shock loading. So the mangroves are amazing at acting as like a shock absorber. They're kind of bendy. And I don't know if you've ever climbed around the mangroves, but they're very strong, but very flexible.
The CMs kill me. I have to stay away from the bugs. But that's good. All right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, they're just designed to withstand those forces and tie off to them. And that's great.
Very just tough in general. So mangroves and or a very sheltered area, and then having good ground tackle. So having a really well-sized, spec'd, high-quality anchor that is going to hold well, and then having plenty of chain and having a very high-quality bridle to attach so that your windlass isn't taking the load. You want to make the boat cleats take the load, or your beam, if it's a catamaran, the beam brackets. And actually, I've heard people talk about doubling up in a really severe storm on catamarans and not loading the beam brackets at all, but going to their primary cleats, their primary bow cleats that aren't on the bow beam itself. Because the concern is that you would rip that off. I've never seen a case of that happening, but I'm sure it has. That the rumor must exist for a reason. So that's one thing. And then chafe protection. When it comes to anchor situations, it's really hard because the amount of movement and the amount of load, because you have one point essentially securing your boat, and it's tough to deal with. And also being aware of where the boat's going to swing when the storm rotates, because you might be set up perfectly for when the storm initially hits and the wind's, say, coming out of the north, but then by the end of the storm, when the bottom rotation's coming past you and it switches and the clock's around to the east and then south, you're going to have a bad time if you're suddenly blowing up on some beach because you didn't prep well.
Wow, yeah. And is there, I always forget, what's the more violent part of the hurricane as it comes into you, or as it passes over in the back end?
So typically the leading eastern edge is the most violent part of a hurricane. And it's something to do with the direction that the storm is moving in. I can't remember the specifics on this, but it's to do with the directional rotation and the direction the storm moves in, but typically that northeast quadrant is the most violent. And then once it passes over you, you're going to be getting a lighter version of what you initially experienced. So the first part to hit you is going to be the worst in general.
Okay. All right. So it's not the back end.
Right.
Okay. Man.
Unless the storm intensifies, because that's happened in places where, like the initial part of the storm, it's only a cat 2 or 3. And then by the time it's, you know, passed over you, it's strengthened, and now you've got a cat 4, because they can strengthen in hours. And then it, for sure, you know, you have 50 miles an hour on the way in and 80 on the way out. So it would, you know, it would suck to be tired and then get beat up like that. With a cat 5, it's almost all bets are off. Like, there's not a whole lot you can do. Like, masts get blown over, bare masts just get blown over, which is wild to think about.
Yeah, that is crazy.
Like a well-rigged boat. Now, I don't know if the majority of that. No, I mean, you see anchorages where multiple masts, like, they're all just down. There's no masts standing, even though the boats are still upright. That's wild.
Man, that is. Just how supported a mast is, that in the surface area is only so much.
Right.
But then, you know, there's tornadoes in Texas where it drives straw into telephone poles.
Right.
So,
you know. Yeah, the power of the wind.
Happens. Yeah.
Is, but when you think about, like, the riding moment, like, how much load it takes to tip a boat over, and they, like, we're going to do it in a couple days. We're going to tip a boat over 30 degrees. And not break the mast because it's rigged appropriately.
So yet how far the did wind that boat just, have to go over to break it?
Or I mean, how fast did the wind have to hit that the boat didn't have time to heal?
That much
it's the
force,
shock
that
loading.
That makes sense.
That there's just no time for it to heal. It just goes like a
snap.
16,000 pound 3/8 shroud just goes pop. Like, unreal. Or does the mast just fold? Like,
right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, does it fold before the water is even popping? Is it
right? Is it because of a shroud failure or because the aluminum just can't withstand the loads?
Yeah, that's wild. So where do you fall on, like, using stern anchors?
I believe they are too much risk for the potential benefit in a storm. I use stern anchors all the time on a beautiful day at the beach. But during a storm, it's... One, your stern anchor is typically your secondary anchor, which is a lot smaller and probably not going to suffice in a storm anyway. And two, the chances of you spinning and tangling the anchors around each other in heavy enough wind, dragging the stern anchor and then turning it around and then the stern anchor tripping up the primary anchor is too great, that I would just focus on being 100% set, having your primary anchor set really, really well with tons of chafe protection and monitoring that, and that being kind of your Hail Mary. That, and one thing I forgot to mention, is having your engines ready to run. It's a well-known documented fact that it's a very good practice to have the engines running in gear straight into the wind. And so you're motoring at like 1500 RPMs or whatever it takes to take the load off of the anchor during the storm. It's a great technique because it lets the engines work with the anchor to hold you secure. So having well-maintained engines that you know can just run really hard for 4, 6, 8 hours, depending on the size of the storm, is a massive means of survival. Because if you think about it, a cruising boat should be able to motor at 1 or 2 knots into 60 knots of breeze. So if it's blowing 80, 90, 100, and you were basically able to motor such that you would only be dragging back at half a knot, 1 knot, 2 knots, and then letting your anchor just take up the remaining of that load, is a massive, massive load savings.
And what if you have 2 bow anchors? Is that helpful at all or no?
I think that would be helpful if you knew for sure the wind was only going to blow in one direction. Because again, if the storm, or when the storm rotates 180 degrees, you're going to spin around and then those 2 anchors are going to be crossing over each other. And my primary concern would be chafe. But then I also am concerned that one's going to pull free drag and trip up under the other one, tangle the chain. And again, it's probably only going to load up one at a time. To have it set up so perfectly that you're actually sharing the load between 2 anchors, it's incredibly hard to do. And which one's going to fail first? The secondary. And so, yeah, I think keeping it simple, having the secondary available to throw out if like your chain snaps and you're drifting onto the shore and you want to, you know, Hail Mary, let me throw this secondary anchor out there and then use my engines and try and be okay. That makes more sense to me than the complication of having 2 sets of gear out there.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. What about your wind instruments, like your anemometer up there? Is there anything that you would pull down ahead of time that you would worry about that's expensive up there that you might lose?
That's a good point. In Irma, I actually did prep. And it's funny, all the stuff I did in Irma was totally unnecessary because we had some northerly 50 knot gusts. It wasn't, or maybe 60, but it wasn't crazy. But yeah, I did remove the anemometers, the masted wind instruments. I don't think there's anything else. I didn't remove any lights because that stuff can definitely, I think, take it in general. But yeah, I've seen many of the anemometer cups get blown off and vanes get blown off in smaller storms. So I removed ours.
Yeah, those little dudes are expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
$350 minimum.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, even the little internal parts and stuff, just replacing things, it's just a pain. They're easy to pull. So
yes, yeah, okay. Exactly. While, you know, it's a one trip up the mast to potentially save yourself a bunch. And some people really want to watch the wind speed.
See, I was going to say that as like,
it's very tempting. If it's just being a data nerd, I'm not taking it down. I'm watching. Yeah, I mean, I have my chart plotter linked to a TV screen inside. And during this last, I think it was ETA or something that came over last year, I didn't sleep much at all because I was watching things and I was laying inside drying off every time between going out and just staring at the screen watching for the gusts. And
yeah, it'd be hard not to know. But if it's big enough, it's like, man, we know it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
I can just turn on the news.
Exactly.
I don't have to know that localized.
Right, right. There's always a weather buoy or something nearby that's going to tell you what's actually going on. So, yeah. Or if you just want to throw caution to the wind and not care about your wind instrument and collect your data, cool. But it's your money.
That's right. Yep.
Fenders are obviously a vital component, especially if you're up against a floating dock. If you've done a good job of spiderwebbing your boat into the center of a slip where you're actually not going to touch at all, that's the perfect situation, but you still will want to have as many fenders as possible. So if you're going to be riding up on a dock, for sure, like I am in my current slip situation, I hang my long fender sideways so they cover a wider area so that when I surge around, they don't pop or not pop it, but bump, jump out of the way, and then monitor them as closely as possible. It's actually the thing I have to watch the closest when my boat's in the storm because of my slip, because I can't very easily hold myself off. Even though I have that anchor, I'm sharing the load between that anchor and my fenders. But It's fenders are obviously critical, and I tell everybody, one major gel coat repair is far going to outweigh the cost of a few high quality fenders, because people see fenders are expensive. You can very easily drop $300 on a large fender, but I have three of them on my boat, and I guarantee you it has saved me thousands and thousands of dollars in gel coat repairs. So money well spent, and they're going to last a very long time.
Are the inflatable fenders any good?
Yes, that's what I have.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's work, because it just takes up so much space otherwise.
Super long warranty. They're Polyform, I think, is what I have. But there's several good brands out there. And yeah, for a long passage, I would just deflate them and store them in the locker. And for short day passages, I actually tie them up on the trampolines, and the kids bounce around them and play on them. So
what does that use? A foot pump? Like a
yeah. Yeah, like for or electric. Or I actually have both. Oh, I have an electric pump, little 12-volt pump, and then a little foot pump. A bicycle pump will pump them up too, though.
And now they have power tool, like the power tool manufacturers make pumps.
Yeah, a little compressor.
It just uses your battery that your drill use.
Mm-hmm.
Milwaukee.
Yeah, forgot about that.
Of course, has one. For sure. It's awesome.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but yeah, they're designed to be pumped by a bicycle pump. They come with little adapters so that essentially anyone can do it. I, of course, because I own a shop, I cheat and I come here and I use a compressor.
Nice. Yeah, that helps.
So yeah, it's definitely helpful.
Is there anything to be aware of between a storm coming like that and being on a floating dock versus a fixed dock?
Absolutely. Definitely several considerations. The ideal situation is a really high quality floating dock that has very secure concrete pilings, high quality floating pontoons. And so no matter what the surge, the location of your dock cleats, because they're on a floating platform, is not going to change. So your dock line lengths aren't going to be affected at all by the amount of surge. Whereas on a fixed dock, if the tide comes in like it did actually in that last storm for us here, and the fingers were underwater, so where my dock cleats are usually tied off was 5 feet lower than when the storm started. One, I mitigated that by tying off the majority of my dock lines to the pilings and not the dock cleats. So I changed my configuration slightly so that all of my dock lines were initially tied up higher because we were expecting surge. And the opposite can be the case, that you can expect a drain, like a reverse surge, like actually what happened in Irma, where all the water just basically got sucked out of Tampa Bay. It was crazy. So boats are resting on the bottom where you hadn't seen the bottom in decades. So again, the most important thing there is having appropriate length runs on your dock lines, not having any very, very short spring lines or very short bow or stern lines that will be severely affected by the change in geometry of the boat, either rising significantly or dropping significantly. So you have to basically imagine, hey, where is my boat going to go during the storm in terms of rise or fall, and is everything going to be okay? And thankfully, dock lines are pretty stretchy, so they can take a lot, but you 100% have to be cognizant of that with a fixed dock. Floating docks are much easier.
And if it's the kind of storm that you're going to leave on, would you say above a Cat 2? When did you say, like, maybe, I mean, as a general rule, everyone has to make their own decision, but
if it's a severe Cat, I would say the general rule would be anything above a Cat 2. So a Cat 3 and above.
Okay.
I've been through enough that I would, and I'm young and agile enough too, because I can actually, you know, move around the boat still. If you're elderly and it's tough getting on the boat in good weather, there's no point in being on your boat when the weather's really bad. There's just not a whole lot you're capable of doing.
Sure.
You know, like, you need to be able to move around and push. And in the last storm, I was jumping off my boat constantly, running to help other boats. And whereas if I was in my 60s with a bad knee or something, it just, there'd be no point.
Yeah, just more risk.
Yeah, I'm a liability at that point.
So then the question is, what do you do? What's the best decision to make on dock line links and these kind of things if you're not there to make adjustments?
It's really tough. You again, the longer the angles, so if your spring lines are nice and long, you want to use the cleats that are as far away as possible that will still perform the way you want them to. It'll give you the most stretch. And so I'm trying to think of a good verbal example to explain how the angles matter, because I can hold my arm out really straight, right, and move it up and down. The angle change doesn't affect how the length of my arm feels, whereas if I'm, you know, moving, if something's much closer to you, the angle is much more severe. And I'm trying to think of a good way, like that scissor effect that causes is, but yeah, the longer your dock lines in general, the better. Like, nothing less than 15 feet. If the distance between your boat, cleat, and whatever you're tied to, less than 15 feet, you're taking a risk. Because a, let's say a 5 foot drop, that's 30% of that line length. And if you have a 7 or 8 foot surge, now that line has just been cut in half in terms of overall length. Because you see people trying to like secure their boat down super secure.
Yeah,
they're
with
like,
the water right where it's at.
Like
yeah.
The lines are like this from like the dock up to the boat. And then the first surge that happens, the line just goes and either pulls the dock cleat out or I have chafe gear on my fender lines for storms so that it doesn't like saw a hole in my gel coat.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Like
yeah.
legit, like it'll saw a hole into the gel coat.
That makes sense. Yeah. Sure. All those forces.
So there's, I have the cloth, soft cloth chafe gear for the fender lines and then really hard like fire hose type stuff for the dock lines where they go around cleats and sharp dock edges. And then I have lots of random spare pieces of chafe gear that during the storm when the surge angle changes, I can run around and place it so that my dock lines don't get it. And then I've got pieces of leather that are permanently stitched to some of mine where I know they potentially will chafe. There's all kinds of ways you can. And then clear reinforced hose is the go-to easy available staple. You just go buy a bunch of 1-inch clear reinforced hose and zip tie it, slide it on the lines or split it and zip tie it in multiple places. That stuff is tough as nails.
That's the stuff with the wire you can see in it, right?
With like the mesh looking
Yeah, it's like
stuff.
That mesh. Uh-huh.
Yeah, not the coiled wire because that's really hard to cut and then it'll be metal.
For sure. Yeah, that's
metal
different.
On your line. But
yeah, it's that mesh.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
you see in classroom windows.
Yes, because you can split that with a Stanley knife and then just pop it over the dock line kind of wherever and then just put zip ties on the end and it's incredibly tough. It works great. But it can also get kind of gooey when it really, really chafes. It'll leave, you can get it off, but it leaves marks to get off the gel coat.
Well, that wraps up this episode of the On Deck Podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed listening. Thanks so much for your support. And we will see you guys next time for episode number 4 of the On Deck Podcast. Please check the link down below and the show notes for all of our other various related media. Take care, guys. Fair winds and following seas. Sailor Smurf out.